At the moment, we are going through a series of lectures on the Gospel of John. And this is lecture number 9 in that series, which I have entitled The First Sign. Now, you all know that John has a Gospel in which he has taken miracles and turned certain of them, 7, perhaps 8, depending on what school of thought you come from. And he's turned those miracles into signs to prove that Yeshua was the Messiah that was expected during the Second Temple period by the Jewish people. And so I have subtitled this lecture today, The First Sign, The Attack on the Jerusalem Temple. Now, this will go for a few weeks, because most Christians are totally unaware that Yeshua attacked the temple of God. He seized the temple of God. Now, I have gone through this in previous lectures. In fact, I'll say this, that my lectures are always controversial. I don't want them to be, but they just turn out that way. And intriguingly, I said once, the real Apostle Paul lectures were the most important lectures I have ever given. And they were. Then I gave the Apocalypse lectures, and I said that the Apocalypse lectures were the most important I've ever given. And they were. But you know what? This series on the Gospel of John are perhaps the most important, or why should I say perhaps? They are the most important series of lectures I've ever given. And that is because of their implications that are relative to us today in the Messianic movement. It's important for us, if you are dislocated from the previous lectures on the Gospel of John, and you've got access to the board, revive your interest. Start again. Go through the previous 8 so that you understand where this series is leading, where this series is going. It is most important. As I've said many times, we are not here to indoctrinate. We are here to educate. All right? Big difference. And I was just saying to a lass here today, when you come, just remember, do not leave your brain at the door. Bring your brain with you. All right? Most important to do so, to continue to think about what it is you are hearing and what it is you are reading. Because some of us have been with us, oh my goodness, James, you've been with us since, what, 1981, 82? Yeah. So, over a period of time, you can get so used to hearing Les Aaron Gosling that everything that comes out of my mouth is ex cathedra. Don't do this. Continue to utilize the book. Mind you, the Jews wrote the book. If you want to understand what the book is all about, you ask the Jew. You don't go to the local minister down here of the Presbyterian Church and ask him all about Roman Catholicism. You go to a priest. Why? Because the priest represents Roman Catholicism. If you want to understand about veterinary science, you don't go to a herbalist.
Right? You go to a dentist.
You go to a dentist. If you want to know about dentistry, you don't go to the Glamico up at South Tweed to find out about that. Go to the source. But when you go to this source, be prepared to inculcate what it is that you read God wants of you.
It's hot sauce.
Sorry?
It's hot sauce.
It's what?
Hot sauce. You said go to the source and let it.
Oh, yes. Okay. Don't mind me.
Fire. So hot.
Yeah. So, okay. By way of introduction to this lecture, I want us to turn to John chapter 10. Have a look at verse 22. It was at Jerusalem, the feast of the dedication, and it was winter. This is the festival of Hanukkah. And Yeshua walked in the temple in Solomon's porch. Incidentally, there are some people, some Messianics, that observe Hanukkah, and there are some that do not. It is not in any way, shape or form, necessary to observe it, but we certainly recognize Hanukkah when it comes around. We understand its teachings, we understand its application, and this particular section of the Bible is used to prove that Yeshua observed it as well, but it doesn't say that. We've got to be very careful here. All it says is he walked around the temple, Solomon's porch. Doesn't say that he observed it. Right? And we know from the Second Temple period that certain sects of the Jewish people did not observe it. Right. So, then they came the Jews around about him and said to him, "How long do you make us to doubt? If you be the Messiah, tell us plainly." Tell us plainly. So the timing is the festival of Hanukkah, the festival of dedication, the festival of lights, the festival of renewal, the final great Jewish celebration just prior to the Passover. And Judas Maccabeus instituted this celebration as a consequence of the rededication of the temple of God after it was cleansed of the profanation, and that's not too strong a word, of Syrian filth. And we heard a little bit about that in the Parsha today. They took the sacred animal of the Syrians, which was the pig, abhorred all over the world. In fact, in the bamboo annals, you will find that the Chinese said, "A gentleman does not eat a pig." So in the ancient world, the pig was considered unclean except for the Syrians. And Antiochus, the fourth Epiphanes, the Syrian king,
really stirred up, didn't he?
Well, he did. And he sacrificed the sow on the altar. And the celebration of Hanukkah, the original celebration, lasted for 8 days. And in this account here in John chapter 10, John mentions it was winter. Well, all the Jews at the time would know it was winter, right? They know it was winter over there in the Holy Land. But John never puts anything in his gospel which doesn't have a subtext. And of course, the underlying subtext is often overlooked. Unless you're a Jew reading a Jewish book with Jewish eyes and an appreciation of Jewish thought form. And it may well have been the season of winter, which of course it would have been, proving again that Yeshua wasn't born at that time of the year, because, you know, the shepherds wouldn't be out in the field with the sheep. They'd have them under a building, under a barn, yes. But this statement inferences and inculcates a further intention. John is talking about the disposition of the heart of man. It was winter, he writes. And that's the heart of man. The heart, Jeremiah said, is desperately wicked. And the Hebrew is, the heart is desperate for wickedness. It despairs for it. If it doesn't get what it wants, it despairs. And that heart of man is wicked to the point where another particular author in the Bible said it is the worst thing on earth. The heart of man can be good or it can be evil. And we are a mixture of both. The yin and yang of human behavior is reflected in the way we present, the attitudes we possess, and indeed our view, our world view of God. If we don't have a God, doesn't matter whether it's God the Father, God the Son, God the Holy Ghost, or God the television, whatever is our God, if we don't have a God, we are in trouble. Psychiatrists the world over will recognize that. You have to have something in which to focus for your life to have any stability or success. And John looks at the heart of man and he sees it as evil. Be that as it may, even evil hearts can do good things and be good toward others. But we need to analyze who and what we are, and not to shy away from what we see. I remember a lady came here Glennis will remember this too, and some of you will. She was brought by another person, and we didn't know this woman from Eve. And the Rebbetzin said to her, look, sometimes the Rebbe, he has a few things to say which are rather
controversial.
Well, not controversial, they're hard.
Jarring.
It's jarring, thank you. And she said, oh no, I've been everywhere. She said, nothing can jar me. Well, it took 10 minutes, I think it was, of my lecture, and she was out that door. She ran so fast, nothing could have, you know, stopped her. And because she came with somebody else, she sat in the car outside in the heat of the day, no air conditioning, waiting for this to finish so this other lady could go out with her. But she couldn't handle what I was having to say, because she was indoctrinated with fairy tales and other nonsense. And so when I spoke plainly on some of the issues, she couldn't handle it. And it was very sad to see, because I'm sure had she been able to handle it, to stay with it, she would have grown through it. But priestly enemies gathered around Yeshua at this occasion and began to agitate. They said to him, show us your credentials. Show us your credentials. They said, how long will you go on keeping us in suspense? If you are the Messiah, tell us openly. What's the subtext? Now remember, this is the Feast of Hanukkah. So what would be on their minds? Well, the cleansing of the temple would be on their minds. Judas Maccabeus' overthrow of Assyrian tyranny. And so when they say, if you are the Messiah, tell us openly, the subtext would be, will you, Yeshua, will you now break the power of Roman authority? Will you, if you are the Messiah, now release us from the Roman yoke of slavery and from Roman government and Roman coins and Roman procurators and other Roman desecrations? If you are the Messiah, will you liberate us now from Rome, just like Judas Maccabeus rid us of the Syrians, just like he overturned Antiochus Antiochus the Fourth Epiphanes. In fact, you know what? Look, Epiphanes means manifestation of God. But the Jews didn't like his title, so they called him Antiochus Epiphanes. Now, I'm not going to tell you what that means, but it is a slur and insult, to say the least. It refers to the person's mental stability, that is quite true, but it's also, I'm sure in the Second Temple period, it sort of came out in toilet humour. Let me put it out.
Eshelai.
Pardon?
Eshelai?
Very much. And so they would say, are you going to do this, and are you going to cleanse and purify the temple of God as he did? Openly proclaim yourself. Who are you, Yeshua? Who are you? Now, Yeshua, as we have seen in the last lecture, if you were here, Yeshua felt that hour of his was dawning. He referred to, my hour has not yet come, etc., and so forth. And at Cana, the water was turned into wine. That's the first sign that John is giving us, and we're still on the first sign, and we're now lecture 9, and we're still on it. And he knew that at Golgotha, that wine would be turned into blood. So for the first time, he eyeballed these priests. And if you look at verse 30, he says something startling. He says, I and my Father are one. I and my Father are one. And with that, he challenged them to a new understanding of the Shema. Shema Yisrael. Adonai Eloheinu Adonai Echad. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. And here he is saying, I and my Father are one. Then he emphasized in verse 36, I have told you I am the Son of God. What was their response? They picked up rocks and stones to kill him. Now, I've heard sermons in the past where ministers have said, we don't know where all these stones came from. Because every time Yeshua was going to blaspheme, as they saw it, they pick up stones. Where did all these stones come from? And I'm sitting in the congregation thinking, have you missed the point of this whole exercise?
And anyway, it was Judea.
Well,
the place is rocky.
Look, the stones, where did Yeshua, where did the priests usually confront him?
In the temple.
In the temple. The temple had not yet been completed. There would have been rocks and stones all around the place. In fact, in John 2, chapter 2, verse 20, the Jews say, for 46 years we have been building this temple. And it's present continuous tense. It hadn't been completed. In fact, it wasn't completed, according to Josephus, until 64 CE, which was 6 years before it was destroyed. So there would have been plenty of rocks and even boulders around. Not that they were going to pick up a boulder, but you know.
I think so, yeah.
No, look, you know.
Their father David had great use for stones, and so they learned from him and always carried a few around.
Always carry a few in your pocket, yeah. Look, there would have been an arsenal of rocks and stones around. Earlier than this, if you go back to chapter 8 and look at verse 12, earlier than this situation, Yeshua made a declaration. He said, I am the light of the world. He said, I'm the light of the world. And I've heard again sermons which say, oh yes, you know, the sun represents Jesus and so he's the light of the world. You know, the sun gives light. No, he's talking about the menorah. It's a Jewish thought form. He's talking about the menorah, and he's saying, I am the living menorah.
Makes sense.
I am the light of the world. He who follows me can never walk in darkness. He will possess the light which is life. We all walk in darkness because darkness is ignorance. And we all are ignorant to one degree or another. It's a matter of how much light we are allowing into our lives. Hear me, we are allowing into our lives. We control what comes in here. There are degrees of darkness, and there are degrees of light. But if we are open to what the Ruach HaKodesh, the Holy Spirit, is saying to us, and in his leading of us, we will be open to the knowledge and the truth of God. Whether that is in the biblical sense, in a medical sense, in an astronomical sense, in a mathematical sense, whatever. We will be open to learning and to growing in an understanding of what God's truth is for us. This is the foundation of all knowledge. Yet people are destroyed for lack of knowledge. The prophet said, my people are destroyed for lack of knowledge. Remember that? And that same prophet goes on to lay the responsibility for that lack of knowledge on the priesthood. He says, therefore, you will no longer be a priest to me. And the priests are the ones who have this knowledge and should be teaching this word to people. But all around the world, we have a dearth of knowledge in the churches. And so you find now churches are losing their members. Because there's nowhere else to go. They stay outside. They've been burnt in other churches. The stories that Robertson and I could share about people who have come to us where ministers have extracted the tithe out of their people.
Right.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You're not wrong there. Are enormous. We had a lady that came to us, and when we explained the whole tithing thing, she was so happy. She was in tears because her husband and her had been living in a cockroach-infested place, and her father turned around finally and said, no more. I'm giving you a wedding gift. He said, I never gave you one when you married because I didn't want you married. But he said, you're married now, and here's a wedding gift. And he gave them a check. And he said, go out and get yourself a unit. He was a very wealthy man. So they did. And shortly thereafter, they went to church, and the minister up there in a particular Pentecostal assembly said, which is up here in Surfers Paradise, he said, is there anybody with any praise points today? And she put her hand up so enthusiastic, and she said what her father had done for them and how much that he had given. And they sank it into this place. There was a knock on the door in days, just within days. The minister and his pastoral team, not just him. You are a member of our church, yes, I am. Well, we've worked out that your tithe will be, and handed her the account. Now, how blatant, how evil, how wicked, how rotten, and how demonic is that?
Filth.
Filth doesn't say it. Comes close to it. She came to us in desperation, and I said, well, and I explained all about the tithe and what it isn't. She was absolutely amazed. I gave her a copy of the literature that I had on it. Needless to say, she left that church.
Good.
But we got bad-mouthed by the ministry for liberating somebody. I am the light of the world. He who follows me can never walk in darkness. He will possess the light which is life. Yeshua becomes for John the Apostle the menorah itself, giving light to the entirety of the human race. Remember, according to the New Testament, Yeshua didn't come to kill people, to destroy people, to burn people for all eternity. That's a myth. That's why no Jew, no true Jew, ever unites with a church and stays with it. Because sooner or later, that gospel of damnation has to be rejected by an intelligent, thinking mind. And in Jewish theology, there is no such thing as an ever-burning hell. It doesn't exist. Because it's not in the Hebrew Scriptures. You won't find it in the Hebrew Scriptures. It's not there in the Hebrew Scriptures. And you know what? It's not there in the New Testament either, which was also written by Jews. You won't find it. In fact, you'll find the universal salvation mentioned so many times, it's hard to keep count. The ministers I have spoken to about that subject who admit it's correct but will not preach it is myriad. Hypocrites, liars in the pulpit. For God so loved the world. World, not church. For God so loved the world that he gave his uniquely begotten Son, that whoever believes in him should not perish, but have everlasting life. For God sent not his Son into the world to condemn the world, but that through him
the world could be saved.
Augustine didn't like that, so Augustine said, where he saith world, he meaneth church. Well, I'm sorry, Augustine. You got rats in your head. He says, world. W-O-R-L-D. And this is why I preach and have preached for almost 40 years now the gospel of universal salvation. And instead of ministers saying, this is wonderful news, oh, we didn't know for 300 years the church believed it. We didn't realize that for 500 years universal salvation never appeared on any list of creeds. No, it didn't appear because everyone believed it for 500 years. And then a doctrine was introduced which made some money for the church. It was called purgatory. And from purgatory emerged an ever-burning hell. You have purgatory or you have hell. Or you have heaven. I'm sorry, you've got to read that into the scripture. It's not there. And if it was there, why didn't the anti-Nicene fathers, which I had read profusely, why didn't they mention it? In fact, why didn't Jerome mention it? Well, Jerome believed in a universal salvation too. Clement of Alexandria, Clement of Rome. You name the early church fathers, they all, to a man, believed in a universal salvation. But suddenly, you find, around about 700 AD, thereabouts, this other doctrine of eternal torture being introduced. And why? For the control of the masses. Yes, I've had ministers, I've sat in the lounge rooms of ministries, of ministers who have ministries that are global. And they all admit, oh yes, well, it's an open-ended thing, we know that. Yeah. Well, why don't you tell your people? No, we'd lose the plot. It's the same argument about tithing. Why don't you tell people the truth about tithing? Oh, we'd lose our support. What do you do?
Can't do.
You can't do anything.
That's why there's a new one coming. Even an earthly one coming. Because this one's going to wear itself out. Not the world, I mean, but the church itself. Mm-hmm. It's bringing about its own demise.
Well, it is. Mm-hmm. Even Yeshua himself said at the end of the age, he said, when the Son of Man returns, will he find the faith on the earth? That's a good question. Have a look for a moment at John chapter 8. We just looked at verse 12, where he declares himself the menorah of the world, the light of the world. That's in verse 12. Now remember, as I've shown you in previous lectures, that the wonderful story of Yeshua and the woman taken in adultery, great story, but it's not in the original. It's not in the Gospel of John at all, and sometimes it appears in the Gospel of Luke. They can't make up their mind where to put this. But this story has no part of the Gospel of John. But all authorities recognize it was added. So if you look at verse 1 of John 8, right down to verse 11, it's a beautiful story, and it should be kept as an addendum to the New Testament, because it's reflective of what Yeshua would have been like. So I think it originated with Papias, but I could be wrong about that, but I think it is. Anyway, that should be kept as an addendum, but not left in the Gospel of John. It was added there, and if you've got it in the Gospel of Luke, it shouldn't be there either. But if this is the case, and it is, then verse 12, which we have just read, really carries on from verse 52 and 53 of John, chapter 7.
Right? 53, I've got here, is part of that
spirit. Yes, it is, but there is a very early manuscript which does have it. It's only one manuscript, but it's there. So if you have a look at verse 52, you've got Nicodemus arguing with the Sanhedrin about Yeshua. And in verse 52, the priest answered and said to him, "Are you also of Galilee? Search and look, for out of Galilee arises no prophet." Alright? And then an early manuscript contains this last verse. Every man went to his own house. Now this is rather interesting. Because John is telling us, or whoever wrote verse 53 is telling us, they went to their own house. They left there, they left the temple, they went and returned to their own homes. They returned to their own prisons of despair. Their own indulgent, self-contained mental torture chambers. locked into their own abominable ignorance and self-righteous self-deception. They didn't want to stick around the temple of God where the menorah was. They left there. They left there and went back to their own dwelling. But, you know, had they not been so self-deceived, so self-righteous, had they been otherwise open-minded and rejoicing in the biblical revelation, they would have recalled that Jonah, Hosea, Elijah, Elisha, sometimes called Elisha, and other prophets of the living God had not originated in Judea. They had come from the northern kingdom. And yet they turn around and they say, are you also of Galilee, Nicodemus, or Nakdamon, Ben-Gurion, which is what his name really was? Look, out of Galilee arises no prophet. Ignorance. And that's why John includes it. It's an ignorant priesthood. Now, up here on the whiteboard, I've got, forget all this other business, I'll come to that in a minute. John tells us, as we've seen in the last 8 lectures, that first sign at Cana, that first miracle of turning water into wine, Yeshua attacks the ritual and ceremonial procedures of the temple. Because in the miracle at Cana, those 6 water pots were the purification jars of the Jews. All right, he attacks that. He calls the waters insipid. Then he attacks the temple, seizes control of the temple, declares it unholy. Then he tells the priesthood that they're unspiritual, and finally that the Sanhedrin is ignorant. And you can go to John chapter 3 and see Nakdaimon Ben-Gurion, or Nicodemus as he's called, comes to Yeshua by night. He sneaks in by night. Yeah. And he says, Rabbi, getting in there really, really chummy with Yeshua. Rabbi, that's a Sanhedrin, we know that you are the teacher come from God. They admitted it. And the Greek says the teacher, not just a teacher, the teacher, meaning the highest teacher. And Yeshua turns around and he says, are you, being the teacher of Israel, ignorant? Don't you know these things? So Yeshua is referring to Nakdamon Ben-Gurion as the top brass in the Sanhedrin. And they're both calling each other the teacher of Israel, which I find interesting. But rabbis admit that the Second Temple period reflected, quote, the decline of the generations. In other words, we've hit the bottom, fellas. There's no further place to go except up, because we are so degenerate. So decadent. In Hebrew, the decline of the generations, yerigot ha-dorot, and that means basically you can't get any worse than what we've got now. And that's the rabbinic assessment of the Second Temple period. I'm going to come to that a little bit more in detail later. Now notice too that Yeshua does not say, my teaching is the light of the world. He doesn't say, my teaching. He says, I am the light of the world. It's not the teaching, it's the person. We might have the teaching, but if we don't have the person, we're dead as dead can be. Because it is the light of the world, the menorah of the world, that gives life. You cannot... We've had people come here. Very sincere, loving people who believe that Yeshua is the Messiah, but don't believe he's the Son of God. When Yeshua says, I and my Father are one, they do all kinds of mental gymnastics to get out of the admission that Yeshua was God. He was a great teacher. I had one man come here from up north, and he says, oh no, he said, the Torah only. The New Testament belongs in the trash can. I said, well, you accept Yeshua as Messiah? Oh, yes. I said, well, if you throw the New Testament out in the trash can, you've got no evidence that he was the Messiah.
Sure.
Or he's in the Torah. I said, no, he's not in the Torah unless you use the New Testament to interpret the Torah to understand where he is in the Torah. What? Well, Oh, sometimes my patience wears thin. All of us heard here one day somebody say to us, we can't praise and sing worship songs to Yeshua. Only God can receive that adulation. We all heard it, we were all here. And that person was filled with darkness. They thought it was light. It wasn't light, it was darkness. It was filthy. Have we all heard it? This is what we are up against, brethren. This is what we are up against. Satan does not want anybody in this room or anyone that we can have contact with to be enlightened. He will bring others to distort the very words of Yeshua. I and my Father are one, he said. I accept it. Unreservedly. I accept it. We all know Yeshua cleansed the Jerusalem temple upon his triumphal entry as a proclaimed Messiah. The four gospel authors, Matthew, Levi, Mark, Luke, and John, are generally in agreement about Messiah coming into the temple, overthrowing the tables of the money exchangers, getting a cord, a whip, and using it on the seats of those who sold animals. He smashed the cages of captive birds. He did his law. We don't find gentle Jesus, meek and mild, in that section where he attacks the temple. Or should I say Gentile Jesus, weak and mild. You don't find him. He's not there. He's upset because he says, you've made my Father's house a den of thieves. And he got rid of them. But this is where the general agreement between Matthew, Mark, Luke and John stops. All right? Up to that point, they all are in agreement. Yeshua, according to the evidence of Mark, went a step further. I'm going to show you this in a minute. It should excite you. He went a step further than generally recognized by scholars of the biblical revelation. Now, what am I about to tell you? Just think. What could be so astounding and so new? When Yeshua seized the temple, at the same time that he seized the temple and took control of it, he prevented the continuation of the sacrificial system. And you might go, what? Where's that already? I'm going to show you where it is. And I didn't write it in your Bibles, it's been there all along. But Yeshua literally stopped the sacrifices of Israel. He disrupted the entire religious economy of the nation. So small wonder John takes this episode, which occurred in the last week of Yeshua's life, which eventually led him to crucifixion. He took that episode, John took that last wonderful expression of deity in the life of Yeshua out of context and placed it in his gospel right at the very beginning, as a consequence of the first sign of turning water into wine. This is rather fascinating. Because of what such a striking event signified. Now, notice what Mark records. In Mark 11, verse 16. I want you to make a note of it. Put a little asterisk next to it so you'll never forget this. Because don't forget, John is referring all the time to Yeshua as the living Logos in human flesh here below. And here is an awesome moment in time and space, or really space-time, activated by Yeshua. Now notice what it says. And he, that's Yeshua, would not permit any man to carry any vessel. Now, please notice this. Would not allow any man to carry any vessel through the temple. You might go, oh, well, what's the deal here? It's overlooked. But these vessels, by virtue of their locality, were the sacred ritual and ceremonial vessels utilized directly in the sacrificial system. If you want to make a mental note on paper of that, do so, because it is a most important point, and I've yet to find any scholar who has so assessed it. Now, there's probably scholars out there that have understood this, but I haven't read them. I haven't seen them. I would go so far as to say no vessels in the sacrificial function equals no sacrifices. They're in hand and glove. So what did Yeshua do when he seized the temple? He stopped the sacrificial system. Yet we read this, we read it, and we don't stop to think about what we're reading. Don't forget, this episode occurred in the last week of Yeshua's life, according to Matthew, Mark, and Luke. And Matthew, Mark, and Luke, if you look at the chronology of the Synoptic Gospels, they have Yeshua's ministry lasting for a year. But if you look at the event in John, it occurs right at the very beginning of the ministry of Christ. And according to John's chronology, Yeshua had a 3.5-year ministry. So who's right, the Synoptics or John? And herein lies difficulty for people who are using their brain to think with. But in John's mind, Yeshua came to bring salvation. That's quite true. But you cannot have salvation before you have judgment. Think about it. We have salvation here because of God's judgment on Yeshua. We have Yeshua's judgment from heaven because of the Jews' judgment of Yeshua in Roman-occupied Second Temple history. Judgment all the way along the line. And judgment is not necessarily a negative thing. Judgment can be a positive thing. But to John, Yeshua came to bring judgment upon those who refused to believe. Now, when I say judgment, please take the word condemnation out of my words. I didn't say condemnation, I said judgment. But there were those who refused to believe, despite the miracles which they were right there and witnessed. They were confronted by them. But as John points out, the time of salvation had arrived. We cannot get around John 3:36. Turn over and have a look at it. John chapter 3, verse 36. John is cut and dry. He says, "The one who believes in the Son has eternal life. But the one who refuses to believe in the Son will not see life. Instead, the wrath of God remains on him." Notice the term "the Son." If people accept Yeshua as the Messiah, but born of a human father and egg of a human mother, and do not believe Yeshua is the Son of God, they do not have life. And you know what? The wrath of God abides on them. Will that change? Yes, because as I pointed out in many lectures, there is going to be one day a great white throne judgment. It is not a terrible thing, it's a wonderful thing. Mm. Because the books are open, including the Book of Life. And so look, there is one name under heaven given among men, whereby they may be saved, the name Yeshua. But if you haven't heard of the name Yeshua, and you live your life without knowing Yeshua, you don't have eternal life. So God is going to raise up all those who have never ever had an opportunity to even know about Yeshua during that period called the Great White Throne Judgment and give them eternal life. The Great White Throne Judgment is an age, not an event. This is all understood in Jewish circles, it's not understood in Christian circles, and yet it's coming from a Christian book. All right. John has this attitude that the wrath of God continues to abide on people who are not saved at this time, because he believed that judgment would begin at the temple of God. Malachi chapter 3 verse 1, just make a mental note on paper, you don't have to turn there yet. Malachi 3 verse 1. And according to a variety of views, the Apostle Peter speaks of judgment then and there in his day and age, beginning at the house of God. It tells us that in 1 Peter chapter 4, 17 and 18. And for Peter, the house or temple of God was, for him and for many disciples, the messianic movement, or the ecclesia, or the church, depending on how you want to refer to that first century movement. And remember this about the Gospel of John, because we've been talking about the differences between the Gospel of John and the Synoptic Gospel. We've been exhausting ourselves with all the differences over a period of 8 lectures. And I've been very honest with every single one of you. I've said, there are difficulties, there are problems. And most of you didn't even know those problems existed until I started pointing them out. You were going, what? All right. Some of us need to go back and reconsider the writings of the early church fathers. I mentioned this before. Clement of Alexandria early recognized that Matthew, Mark and Luke pointed to a historic Messiah. But he says John penned a spiritual gospel. And therein we should have seen, very early in the piece, in the history of the Ecclesia, in the history of Christianity, we should have looked at what the bishop of Caesarea, Eusebius, drawing on Clement's lost work, we should have looked at what he wrote in his ecclesiastical history about Clement's views of the Gospels. We should have looked at that and gone, why did he say that? But I've been showing you over 8 lectures why he said that, because there are immense difficulties when you try to take Matthew, Mark and Luke and combine it with the Gospel of John. John is totally different to the others. That's why they're called synoptic. The same. And John is different. Well, John is not writing history, brethren. He's writing theology. This is what I've been trying to emphasize all the way along. He's writing theology. Therefore, he is approaching the life of Yeshua from a different perspective than the historical accounts of Matthew, Mark, and Luke. And he's doing so because he wants his priestly colleagues, because he was a priest, to accept the messiahship of Yeshua. And he will go to any lengths to prove it. People don't realize there are discrepancies that abound concerning the time-related problems of the Last Supper. I'm going to talk about a couple of those today. There are crucial legal interrogations of Yeshua that are overlooked. Even the actual duration of the crucifixion is argued between Matthew, Mark and Luke compared with John. I'm going to show you that in a minute. And again, did John constellate around Roman time or Hebrew time? Because he uses certain terms to describe the calendars of the time, the timing of the day, which are different to commonly accepted Jewish practices in calendrical observance. You might go, well, what difference does it make? Well, it makes all the difference in the world, and this is why I'm here to educate people, because atheists and others out there point to these discrepancies and say, therefore, the Bible can't be true. And I'm showing you that all these differences do exist, which proves the Bible true. I'm taking the opposite approach, because I'm showing that John is accomplishing what he's setting out to do by any and all means which are theological, not historical. Now again, if you can take Matthew, Mark, Luke and John and tie them all together and they all work perfectly and you get a beautiful comparison of the Gospels, you're a better person than I am, because I can't do it. In any event, John has rewritten history. I'm going to tell you now, right now, because to take that cleansing of the temple and put it at the very beginning of his gospel shows clearly he's rewriting history. He's rearranging historical events in order to prove, to proclaim to his priestly colleagues that Yeshua is and was the promised Messiah. And he takes certain miracles of Yeshua, seven of them, or perhaps eight, and he calls those miracles signs. They're pointing to his Messiahship. Now, this is where it's going to get irky if you don't know Jewish thought form. So listen to me carefully now, please. Some of you already understand this, some of you don't. But just think about this. It is John who has the Messiah celebrating a final meal with his disciples the night before the the Passover observance. All right? You all understand that. The other three, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, have Yeshua celebrating the Passover according to the generally accepted Torah timetable. There is a marked divide between scholars as to whether or not the Lord's Supper was even a Passover celebration. There's a reason they feel this. The Synoptic Gospels all claim that it was a Passover meal. Matthew, Mark, and Luke, they all agree it was a Passover meal. Make a mental note on paper, because of the time factor today, I won't go to each of these scriptures. Matthew chapter 26, verses 2, 17, 18, and 19, and Mark 14, verses 12 through to 17. You will read that later and you'll find that all of those references are to Yeshua celebrating a Passover meal together. And if you turn over to Luke 22 and look at verses 7 through to 15, we find that that final meal, called a Passover meal, all the way through, occurs before Yeshua suffers. Right? In fact, he even says, with intense desire have I desired to eat this Passover with you before I suffer. Now, this immediately causes a problem. Because the only way you can actually eat a Passover meal is after the Passover lambs have all been killed and cooked and prepared and put on the plate. But Yeshua was the Passover lamb who died on the 14th of Nisan. All right? And therefore could not have partaken of the Passover meal as such, because it would be kept the very night after he was crucified. So here you've got the synoptics saying it was still a Passover meal. You've got the Apostle John not mentioning it as a Passover at all. So we've got Luke saying, I desire to eat this Passover with you before I suffer. And that suffering took place when the Passover lambs were being slaughtered the following day. So he could hardly, as I said, have eaten the meal, the Passover meal, after he had died. Therefore, how do we tie it together? We have to acknowledge that this Passover dinner was held illegally, prior to the set established Sadducee and Pharisaic alliance, according to the commonly acknowledged Mosaic Torah requirements. And that commanded official Passover meal was on the night following sundown at the end of the 14th of Nisan, which would have been the evening of the 15th of Nisan, the first day of unleavened bread. So, if he presided over an illegal calendrical system, it had to have had some legitimacy. And when you look at the Essenes from Qumran, they did have a Passover meal slightly before the common accepted practice, in the sense that they all sat around and they had bread and wine and looked forward to celebrating the new covenant. What did Yeshua do? He sat with his disciples the night before he died and he had bread and wine and looked forward to a new covenant. He says so. Therefore, the Sadducee and Pharisaic priesthood would have looked upon the Essene ritual as heresy. and as a violation of the Torah. Showing again the connection between Yeshua and his disciples and the early Qumran sectarians. Now, I've talked a lot about this. In fact, on our board, the BRI board, you will find two articles by me back in 1974. One is called The Jewish Calendar Problem, and another one written in 1974, Did Yeshua Observe the Correct Passover in the Year of His Crucifixion? And the more I look into all of the scholarly understandings of people in relation to the four Gospels, the more I realize those original expositions that I did were correct. They've never been proven wrong. Yeshua instituted an entirely new Passover celebratory meal for the evening of the 14th of Nisan, and in the year 30 that occurred on a Tuesday evening, which means that the crucifixion took place on a Wednesday and not a Friday, as we all know, which means he didn't rise from the dead on a Sunday morning. The Bible doesn't say that. He rose from the dead on a Shabbat afternoon at 3 p.m. He told his disciples, he told the priests, that the Son of Man would be in the grave 3 days and three nights. But if you look at Friday as the crucifixion day and Sunday morning as the resurrection, you have not got 3 days and three nights in there. It's impossible to squeeze 3 days and three nights into that. But in ancient Babylon, ancient Chaldea, you had the pagan god Nimrod, or Tammuz as he was also known, or Osiris. He was crucified on a Friday and was resurrected from the dead on a Sunday morning. Well, hello, it didn't take the Roman Church long to take that ancient tradition and inculcate it into the theology of the Western Church. Did you know there were no atheists in the Eastern Church until the Roman priests arrived there? As you know, the Eastern Church, the Byzantine Church, was the Eastern arm of the Great Church. There were no atheists until Roman priests entered the Eastern Orthodox churches and began to share their doctrines. Suddenly you've got atheism. That is a fact of history. And why do we have atheists today? Because they don't want to believe in a God who's going to torture you for all eternity. Bottom line. But if you don't have a God that's going to do that, we should be rejoicing and celebrating Messiah. Not running away going, I don't want anything to do with you. Wetting your pants on the way. I mean, it's yeah. Sorry, I speak plainly. But, you know, this is something we have to look at. Ask ourselves, ask our priests, ask our elders, ask our ministers, ask our pastors. Why are you teaching this drivel? Yeshua died on the preparation day of the Sabbath, which is Friday. Well, yes, it is. But if you've got an annual Sabbath, and there are many annual Sabbaths in the Jewish year, in the Jewish agricultural year, then you would have a preparation day before the high day. And John even tells us that that Sabbath was a high day. And that could fall any time of the week. So those of us who are associated with the IMCF, which is what we are, all around the world, we observe the presence of the Lord on the evening of the 14th of Nisan, following the Karaite calendar, as Yeshua instituted. Not with the nominal Christians who can celebrate the Lord's Supper any time at all. I'm not against the celebration of it any time at all. I'm just saying, however, we observe, as an organization, the original presence of the Lord's celebration at the same time as Yeshua instituted it. If it was good enough for him to institute it, it's good enough for us to keep it on that date, which we do. And we do not subscribe to the Hillel calendar, which is an artificial calendar that Jews today have. God shows us how to determine when the year begins and when the year ends, and the Karaites do that perfectly from Jerusalem. As soon as my contacts over there in Jerusalem tell us when it's to be, it goes up as a notice for all of our brethren to be able to do a proper observance at the right time. In any event, we know that John's Gospel totally ignores the lamb completely. It doesn't mention the lamb. Find it. You won't find it. He doesn't mention the Passover celebration. He doesn't mention the bread and the wine. In fact, he mentions a foot-washing ceremony that the synoptics don't even acknowledge. And people today don't wash each other's feet unless you're a Pope of Rome. Or an SDA. Or us. We do it.
We used to do it in our church.
It's becoming, I suppose it's becoming a popular thing now. I know the AOG tried, when we were in the AOG, they tried to institute it, and everyone went, it'll do it to my feet. So it was the end of that idea. Whatever the case, the synoptic Gospels, Matthew, Mark and Luke, all have Yeshua crucified at 9 a.m. and he dies at 3 p.m. 6 hours of brutal, agonizing torture on the tree of Golgotha. But in John's Gospel, Yeshua is nailed to the tree. It doesn't say cross in Greek either, it's a tree. At noon. Not at 9 a.m., but at the sixth hour, that's noon. And he dies at 3 p.m. So was he up there on the tree for 3 hours, or, as the synoptics say, for 6 hours? John was the beloved disciple, the beloved apostle whom Yeshua loved. He committed his mother into John's hands to look after her for the rest of her life. Therefore, he would have known the truth. But the point is, he's not writing history, he's writing theology. And he wants Yeshua to so epitomize and fulfill every minute of the Torah about the Passover lamb. That's the key that scholars have yet to come to fully understand and appreciate. So did Yeshua fulfill every single detail of the Passover lamb? The answer is yes, no. Yes, no. According to Matthew, Mark and Luke, he did. According to John, he didn't. So John reconstructs the life of Yeshua, and he puts signs out there to point to him as being the total fulfillment of the Mosaic law. You might say, that's a lie! You can say that. And in modern understanding, it's true. It's a lie in our understanding. But they weren't European Jews back then. They were Mediterranean, Middle Eastern Jews, and they thought differently to us. And their thinking is called Semitic. And a Semitism is an expression of overstatement used extensively in the Second Temple period when Yeshua walked the earth. And a Semitism can be explained as an absolute exaggeration to prove a point. Again, you might say, oh no, that's too much. No, it's not. Take yourself back to the Middle East of the first century.
We do it all the time. People say, I went down to the beach today and there were millions there.
Yeah,
well,
right.
No, they weren't,
I laughed so hard, I nearly died. No, you didn't. But you see, that's an exaggeration. You're illustrating how you really felt. Yeshua gave a wonderful example of this use of overstatement or Semitism. He said, see this seed? It's a mustard seed. It's the smallest of seeds. Lie. You ever seen smaller than a mustard seed? Lie. In 21st century understanding, it's a lie. First century understanding, it's a Semitism. And that little seed, when planted, grows into the greatest of trees, said Yeshua. Rubbish! It's a little plant. Semitism. Why? No, it's Semitism. And the birds of the air, Yeshua said, come and they nest in its branches. Rubbish! Sorry, Lord, but it's rubbish. If a crow landed on a mustard seed shrub, it'd crush it, let alone birds, plural. It's a Semitism. It's not going to be in any way, shape or form a proper, correct evaluation of reality. He's using exaggeration to make a point. John is doing the same thing theologically to prove a point. If we can grasp the concept, we would understand why there's no real contradiction. All right? The historical Yeshua did not fulfill every minute of the Torah in relation to the Passover lamb. Didn't do it. Now, it might check the faith of some, but it remains the self-evident truth of the matter. So, to illustrate John's legitimate, hear me, legitimate theological manipulation, want to write that down? Legitimate theological manipulation. Write it down because it expresses beautifully what asemitism intends to convey. If you look at John chapter 12 and verse 1, John chapter 12 and verse 1, 6 days before the Passover, Yeshua came to Bethany, where Eleazar, or Lazarus, we would call him, was, who had been dead, whom he raised from the dead. 6 days before the Passover. Now, the Passover was on the 14th of Nisan, that was a Wednesday. Count back 6 days, and you've got the 10th, which is a Sabbath day. Chapter 12, John chapter 12, verse 1 and 2. There they made him supper. Martha served, but Lazarus was one of them who sat at the table with him. And then Yeshua has his feet anointed, and you get a whole Passover theme coming through in that chapter. So 6 days prior to his sacrifice on the tree of Golgotha, the Messiah arrives at the home of his good friends, Eleazar, Martha, and Miriam, or Lazarus, Martha, and Mary. Now these are the children of his Sanhedrin friend, Nicodemus, or Nachdamon Ben-Gurion. Jewish history tells us that. And he was the older brother of the Jewish historian Josephus. So here it becomes a very family-oriented matter. He spends the night at Bethany, it says so, fulfilling the expectation of Moses' law that the Passover lamb was to be selected at that time and penned up in preparation for its demise. 6 days prior to the 14th. That happens to be the 9th, which is the Friday, Nisan. The ninth, he arrives in the late afternoon, and he then gets cooped up, because in Exodus 12:3 we are told that in the 10th day of Nisan he has to be cooped up, and indeed the 10th day he is cooped up, because that's the Sabbath. Try and keep the chronology of the week in your mind. And all the way through this beautiful story, you find the Passover theme. She spends all that ointment, which is costly, and Yeshua says, "She's done it for my burial." So again, this is a Passover theme coming through at that time. But there's a second point. The Jewish day doesn't start at 12 o'clock at night. It doesn't start when the sun rises. It starts when the sun goes down. Now, at the moment, we're heading toward the dawn of a new day. And this day, the seventh day, Sabbath, will end. And then the first day of the week will begin tonight when the sun goes down, in Jewish thought. The evening and the morning were the first day. The evening and the morning were the second day. The evening and the morning were the third day. That's Genesis chapter 1. And all Jews recognize a calendar difference. This is how we think. So the new day starts tonight. So, his arrival at his friend's home would have been close to sunset on Friday afternoon. His knock on the door would have been at the conclusion of the 9th of Nisan, perhaps an hour or so before sunset. So the Friday night would have been the 10th. That's the Sabbath, would have been the 10th. By that time, Yeshua was penning in for the evening. just like Exodus 7. But John is quick to add that dinner was provided and a woman arrives who anoints his feet with her hair. She's done it for his burial. I've already said to you this was in celebration mode for the Passover theme. And news travels fast. So as you read through this account, have a look at the fact that a great crowd knocks on the door. They're priests, mainly. They want to see both Yeshua and Lazarus, whom he has previously raised from the dead. But notice verse 10 of chapter 12. They arrive with the intention of killing Lazarus a second time. Once wasn't enough because he raised him from the dead. They want to kill Lazarus again. This is how much of a winter was in their heart. Then John speaks of the next day. As you read through there, it says, and the next day, this is what he did. Now here's another problem. What does he mean by the next day? Does he mean the 11th of Nisan, which would have been Sunday, or was it the Sabbath day, which is a daylight portion of the 10th of Nisan? You see, tonight it'll dawn, it'll be the first day of the week, then I can turn around and say, look, tomorrow, well, what am I talking about? Am I talking about Monday? Am I talking about Sunday? I'm talking about Sunday, because tomorrow will be Sunday, even though tonight is the beginning of Sunday, as Jews think. It can get complicated. Now, I recognise the next day could be Sunday, but when you look at John's pen, the way he's writing this, it's a Sabbath. The next day is a Sabbath. So, the Sabbath is important to the Gospel of John, because Yeshua heals all his people on the Sabbath. You find that he disconnects an evil spirit from a human mind on the Sabbath. He restores a withered hand on a man on the Sabbath. A woman with bent back, he makes straight on the Sabbath. A man suffering from dropsy, which is edema, suddenly finds his fluid retention all gone on the Sabbath. On the Sabbath, he opens the eyes of a blind man. Sabbath, 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 Sabbath. Now, I couldn't think of a better day for Yeshua to enter Jerusalem on a bucking, unbroken colt of a donkey to proclaim himself the Mashiach. I couldn't think of a better day to do it. I couldn't think of a better day to declare openly who he was and to lay claim to a messianic prophecy of Zechariah, chapter 9, verse 9, that the Messiah, when he comes to Jerusalem, would be described just in this fashion, on the back of an unbroken ass. And according to John, the population of Jerusalem see this wonderful entry as a fulfillment of that specific condition. Here is the Messiah. He has declared himself. They saw him as ushering in that liberty that would come as a consequence of introducing the reign of God in the great millennial Sabbath. So here again the Sabbath theme comes through. But John, again, I remind you, is not writing history. He's writing theology. And there is much symbolism in his gospel, which all scholars of the biblical revelation recognize. And all through his gospel, John is pointing to Yeshua as the promised Messiah, and he will tailor his evidence in favor of it. We wouldn't, because we're so righteous. We wouldn't do a thing like that. And John will use socially acceptable messianic semitisms, or as we would say, exaggerations, to prove his point. Again, I remind you, John took that incident of the temple cleansing and he places it at the very beginning of his gospel, not when it actually occurred, at the very end of his life. Keep that in mind. But you know what? I also think the Sabbath was important because Yeshua declared himself on three occasions, Mark 2:28, Matthew 12:8, Luke 6:5, to be Lord of the Sabbath. He declared himself Lord of the Sabbath. As Lord of the Sabbath, that meant Yeshua could abrogate the Sabbath. He could annul the Sabbath. He could supersede it as the temple priests superseded the Sabbath in their working twice as hard without being condemned on the Sabbath. If he so wished, he could adjust its strictures to accommodate to the needs of humankind. He could do any of these things if he was Lord of the Sabbath, but he didn't do that. What did he do? He loosed the Sabbath day from its observance of accumulated teachings, rituals, ceremonies, and myriads of minutiae of additional rabbinic commandments and rabbinic traditions as to its observance. Now, how do I know that?
Well,
in John 5, hang on, hold that thought. John 5, verse 18. Notice what it says. Verse 17. Yeshua said to the Jews, "My Father works till now, and I work." Now, please notice this is a Sabbath that this occurs. "Therefore, the Jews sought the more to kill him." When it says the Jews, it means the priests. "Because he had not only broken the Sabbath, but said that God was his Father, making himself equal with God." Please notice, John is writing this account, and it is John who says Yeshua had broken the Sabbath. The word "broken" here is a Greek word, and it means loosed the Sabbath. He loosed the Sabbath because they had accumulated the Sabbath with their strictures of how to live, what to do, how to think, what to say, what to not say, what to do. Which shoe do you put on first when you get up in the morning on the Sabbath? And all of that. I got a book, I tried to live under the code of Jewish law for a long, long time. I gave up. I remember we had two people of God, Les and Laurel, and they came to our house one day to meet us. And this particular man, Mr. Christie was his name, he said, "Would you please do a blessing over the meal?" I said, "No." He was shocked. I had enough of blessing over this, blessing over that, blessing over the other thing, blessing over this, blessing over sexual relationships with my wife, blessing over what shoes to put on, blessing over my dog. Bless. Baruch, baruch. Forget it. The code of Jewish law has thousands of commandments about how to live on the Sabbath day. And by the time you try and fulfill every single one of them, you want to die. Give me a gun. Bang. You know. All right. So there was no way I was going to put a blessing on that food. And you know what? Even to this day. Now look, I'm 69. I'm heading toward my 70th. All right? Oh, well, not really, but I'm going to be in a short time. When I get up in the morning and I go to put my shoes on, I am still cursed. Don't forget the blessing of the shoes. There might be a demon standing in your shoes. You've got to make sure that there's no demon in your shoes when you put your foot in.
They still do it to this day. They never face them in toward the bed.
No.
Their shoes or their slippers, they face them out from the bed. Because the demon could get into them that way before they can put their feet in. Because they've come from that angle.
This is the crap that we have to put up with in a synagogue.
So you need a Sabbath to get over the Sabbath.
Sorry?
You need a Sabbath to get over the Sabbath.
Well, one day, it's funny you say that. Look, one day I was preaching in an Anglican church, I think it was many years ago, it might have been, I think it was Anglican. It was High Anglican, yes. I was cooperating with the communion, and I had to share with them. This lady came up later and she said, "What is your day of rest?" You know, pious individual that she was. I said, "Sunday." "Oh," she said, "I am so glad to hear that. I thought as a Jew..." You've got to go, yeah. As a Jew, you would have been keeping that terrible Sabbath day. I said, oh, please don't misunderstand me. I said, Sunday is my day of rest, absolutely. So is Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. I can do anything I want. But the Sabbath is God's day of rest. And I obey God." Huh. She was one of the blue felt hats, what, you know, and the lipstick. All over the chin, you know, just thickly put on there. The point of the matter is that Yeshua loosed the Sabbath of its restrictions. And there's no way I ever want to return. I observe the Sabbath day, I absolutely do. But I observe it with liberty, I observe it with freedom. I enjoy what I'm doing because I'm serving God and I'm obeying God. There is no way. And I'll tell you something, this is not resting up here. I'm working twice as hard as I do any other day delivering a lecture. I don't give sermons anymore, I give lectures. I used to give sermons. In fact, that tape that, wherever I put it, very precious tape, they were sermons in those days. And it's rather funny listening to the contrast. I can't believe it, that stuff is me. I can't believe it. But it's history, and it's valuable for others to know how we progress as teachers in the Messianic world.
But 20 minutes, half an hour was... 20 minutes was allowed, half an hour was endured. Any longer than that, you wouldn't be asked back.
That's right. That's why I'm here.
Not
somewhere else.
All right.
But you were going to say something before.
Yeah, I was going to say, he worked on the Sabbath.
Yes, he did.
And if he wrote...
He didn't do a shopping on the Sabbath.
If you said he wrote in on the Sabbath, he would have done more than a Sabbath journey anyway.
Well, he would have. But, very good point. But, intriguingly enough, when he goes into the... this TIA has given me a touch of them today. I'm finding it very hard to connect the dots. Bear with me. The law in Deuteronomy prohibited an animal working. Right? Now, he's riding on an unbroken foal. He had to have control of that thing. So that broke the commandment in Deuteronomy chapter 4. And it says that the people went out there and they harvested palm fronds.
So they're working.
Could that have happened in the Second Temple period, where thousands of Jews came out and cut branches off and cried out, Hosanna? And it's not Hosanna either, it was Hosanna, meaning save us, liberate us, son of David, son of David. That would have caused a major upheaval. You would have had the Jews having stones being cast at everybody.
Rocks and you
would have
going everywhere.
Rocks going everywhere, but it had rocks in your head. And you would have had the Romans moving in to bring it to an end. Okay? You would have had the Romans intervening immediately. And that didn't happen. So did Yeshua ride on an ass, an unbroken ass, amongst a whole group of asses, into Jerusalem in his triumphal entry on the Sabbath day? Did it happen? My answer? Yes, no. Historically, we don't know when it happened. According to John, it happened on the Sabbath. All right? To fulfill the 10th day and to celebrate what Yeshua was accomplishing in exposing himself as the Messiah. All right. The cleansing of the temple has no end of difficulties for people. So, you've got some scholars saying it didn't happen, mainly Jewish scholars. You've got other scholars arguing for two unlikely temple cleansings. One at the beginning of his ministry, as John says, and one at the end of his ministry, which Matthew, Mark and Luke said. So, proponents of that are Henry Haley and Merrill Unger. If you have Haley's Bible handbook, he puts it in there. If you've got Unger's Bible handbook, it's in there. It's a very popular doctrine, and they've promoted this idea of two temple cleansings over many decades. But one other scholar argues for three cleansings of the temple. This is how ridiculous it becomes. Three cleansings of the temple. Finus Dake agitates for it. He states that, quote, this is the third purification of the temple. This is in his commentary. The first one is earlier in his ministry. The second is a few days earlier than this one at the first triumphal entry. And you read through this and say, how on earth can you get three temple cleansings? It's impossible. I've read and read and read his notes trying to make sense of them. I can't. And then he argues for three Last Suppers. He's a scholar. Mercy. But one man who was a supporter of our work wrote to us, and you might remember this way back in the day, 8 lectures ago. He wrote and he said, "Rather, Yeshua enters Jerusalem on the 10th day of the first month." This is what you wrote, he says. "And according to John, he died on the 14th at around 3 p.m. when the lambs were being slaughtered for Passover." Now he gets very... He's done his homework, and I respect this man. He lives in New York. And you know what? He's a scholar and a gentleman, because he could have said, "This is ridiculous. I'm closing up shop and going home." Instead, he challenged, and he did so respectfully, and I absolutely love that. That's what this place is all about. If you want to know something, if you want to challenge, you put your hand up. You know, I don't mind being interrupted. Been interrupted for many, many years, because this is what this is all about, freedom of expression. Now, he says, and this is very astute, he says, "If the 14th was a Wednesday, and the 13th was a Tuesday, and the 12th was a Monday, the 11th was Sunday, the 10th was a Sabbath, so Yeshua entered Jerusalem on the 10th day. But we read, 6 days before the Passover, Yeshua came to Bethany. The next day a great multitude that had come to the feast, when they heard that Yeshua was coming to Jerusalem, took branches of palm trees and went out to meet him and cried, 'Hosanna! Blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord, the King of Israel.'" Could the people take branches off the palm trees on the Sabbath? Now, look, he saw the question. Mm-hmm. It hovered over him like a sword of Damocles. And he went, "I'm not letting this go. I'm going to write to the Reverend and see what he says." So he was correct in challenging me in this matter. And this is why I've taken pains to illustrate over 8 lectures. And this is the 9th lecture, that John's gospel is entirely theological, not historical. He's not recording history. He's taking a historical event, but then he's reassessing the meaning of that event. And he then realigns it in the gospel the way he wants to as a Semitism. So he's promoting an ideal Messiah. Think about that. An ideal Messiah to his colleagues, his other priests who didn't believe. Now, I'm instantly reminded of the following little story that was in Christianity Today magazine that I used to subscribe to. It's a good magazine. And I found this comment so funny, I typed it out, gave it to my associate pastor of the local AOG in which we assembled. He laughed his head off. His congregation wasn't impressed. Here it is. "Jesus said unto them, 'Who do you say I am?' And they said," the eschatological manifestation of the ground of our being, the kerygma in which we find the ultimate meaning of our interpersonal relationship. And Jesus said, "What?" All right. This illustrates that we need to get our heads around who is Yeshua. We need to realign with the biblical revelation of the Son of God and accept Yeshua for who he is, not who the teachers of the churches say he is, and not listen to people who come through that door, expect them again, they've been here before, who proclaim, "Yes, Yeshua's the Messiah." "No, he's not the Son of God."
They keep wanting to put handles on him all the time, and extras and all this sort of thing.
Well, they want him to be...
Whip it up and...
They want him to be an addendum,
yeah,
an addition to the Torah.
To what he is. Yeah.
And I will not have that about my Yeshua. He died for me. He took it all.
Personal.
And I'll tell you what, I can still smell my flesh burning. Make no mistake. Corrective fires though they might have been.
Well, it's all a myth if we don't believe it.
Of course it's a myth if we don't believe
it.
But this is what they do. And I get angry and I get... What's the word?
Frustrated.
Irate. More than that, I've got to admit.
Outrage.
Well, it's outrage, but it's within control. But, you know... It's in rage. Because, I mean, I'm not Ray Donovan. But I do get insulted for this book and for the God I represent. It's an insult when that occurs.
It hurts, doesn't it?
It does hurt. And you can spend hours with people. You can spend hours and hours and hours and hours and hours. And they'll pour out their problems and you'll try to help them. I'm not a pastor. I don't want to be. There's two pastors here. I don't want that junk. They can have it. I don't want people vomiting their life over me. Sharing, different story. But remember, sharing is a two-way street. And I've got things that I can share with you too. It's a two-way street. I'm a teacher, I am not a pastor. I wouldn't want to be a pastor, as I said, these two. But look at the colour of their hair. I'm quickly following, but...
Yes.
But you know what I'm saying. I'm saying, you know... What am I saying?
Doesn't matter.
You know...
If you can't believe at all in miracles, you might as well give it up.
Well, that's right. That's exactly right. You may as well. All right. John will go to any lengths to prove he was Yeshua was the Messiah. You know what I'm going to do? I'm going to stop there. Because I'm heading toward the actual purification of the temple. What I've given you is a background that leads basically to it. I haven't talked about Matthew, Mark and Luke's account of the temple being purified, nor have I actually described what John has to say about the temple being purified. But it cannot be differentiated from and dislocated from and set aside from the first miracle of Yeshua turning water into wine. Please notice up here, we are still in the first sign. We haven't even got to the second yet, and there are seven signs, or perhaps eight. But this first sign, where Yeshua takes the water and turns it into wine, in fact, I think it was the Robertson a few lectures ago that said, you know what, Catholics would love you, because I was talking about Miriam and her assessment of Yeshua, and telling people, you know, whatever he says, you do it, you know. And yes, there's a little bit of
bossy mother
syndrome there, but the fact of the matter is, Yeshua worked a miracle of astonishing grace when he turned water into wine. And I've covered all of that in the last eight lectures. I'm now in the ninth lecture, and we are now going to end it. I'm going to continue this lecture in 2 weeks from now, because it's important to know what John had to say about the purification process, the cleansing process of the temple, and apply the principles to ourselves. Because that's what John's all about. He's taking the historical event, reassessing it, rearranging it, putting it in a new light, and then he's saying, draw a lesson from this.
Go and do likewise.
That's exactly right. On that note, I'll bring it to an end at this point, and because also my brain is starting to overtire, and after yesterday's episode, I don't want to stress myself out in continuing this on. So I will continue this in 2 weeks. If there are any questions on any of that, yes?
Can I just make a comment?
You can make a comment.
Not a question.
Oh, okay.
John being who he was.
Who he was, yes.
Right? Son of thunder.
Oh, yes.
Son of thunder.
Yes.
Made that of importance. Listed.
Well, that's right.
That's right. That's where his head first goes.
That's exactly right. Yeah, I agree totally.
Passionate.
Are there any other questions on any of that at all? Or any questions? That wasn't a question, that was a statement. So any questions?
You and I.
Sorry?
Question and answer.
Nothing at all? Okay, see you in 2 weeks. And but if you, in the meantime, if you have any thoughts to add to any of that I've given today, don't hesitate to do so.